You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KCMU 90.3 FM. This morning on Community Forum, we are pleased to have with us Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness, a campaign she helped to initiate to end the U.S.-UN sanctions against Iraq. Voices in the Wilderness has organized 31 delegations to visit Iraq, and Kathy herself has been to Iraq 11 times. Kathy, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Michael. Always good to see you again.
Tell us about why you feel the need to have taken 11 trips to Iraq. Tell us about the effects the sanctions are currently having on the people of Iraq.
Well, you know, by the time 1995 December came about, a number of us who had either been to Iraq before or during or after the Gulf War had gotten together really for a conference about conflict resolution, and we were asked to simulate what we might do if we were involved in a certain conflict to try to win people over that wouldn't agree with us. And we found ourselves choosing as a simulated discussion piece the economic sanctions. And I honestly think there was a moment in that process when we all looked at one another with something like horror and shame and thought, we're simulating what we would do if we did anything about the reality that over 500,000 children have died in a country that we've learned to care about. If we don't care enough to really take some kind of action, then how can we ever expect that this is going to change? And one particular friend, his name is Chuck Quilty, he had driven up from Rock Island not to come to the conference but just to see us, and he, in a kind of gravelly voice, said, look, either say you're not really going to do anything about this issue and I'll try to work on it on my own, or say you're going to do something and let's just do it. Now, we didn't know that Bert Sachs was here in Seattle already working on the issue. We were very impressed with what Ramsey Clark had been doing and a couple of religious sisters and going back and forth. But as people who believed in nonviolence and in the possibilities of tinkering with ways to confront, even when you have small numbers, to confront a government that's perpetrating a terrible injustice, once you believe you have an airtight case on your side, we thought, well, it's actually patently obvious what to do. Break the sanctions, commit civil disobedience in a nonviolent fashion, and try to dramatize our confrontation with the economic sanctions as best we can. So we've felt that we've hit on something that's one workable ingredient to keep on traveling back and forth to Iraq in open and public violation of the economic sanctions, and to come back and hit the ground running and try to tell audiences as wide and far as we can, look, this is what we've seen and heard. And I guess I want to say now, when I hear, for instance, or read, reporters from the New York Times or the Washington Post quote unnamed sources, a Western diplomat in Iraq or a United Nations worker in New York, I want to say, wait a minute, why can't we be listening to the 31 delegations who've been to Iraq and are coming back with source material from people working on the ground in humanitarian groups, civil servants, and so very importantly, United Nations workers? Let's hear that side of the story. And of course, now we're facing the situation where two of the coordinators of humanitarian relief, who'd each served a year and a half in Baghdad, senior officials, one an assistant secretary general of the United Nations, resigned their positions. I'm thinking of Dennis Halliday and Hans von Schepenick, because they said they couldn't have the freedom to speak out while they held those positions. And when they speak out, they feel in conscience that they need to say that what the State Department is telling the U.S. media and the U.S. people is not true. So we want to be voices in not only perhaps a wilderness of compassion, but really a wilderness of information. And we keep hoping that if people in the United States were informed, if they knew that these economic sanctions are costing the lives of 4,000 to 5,000 children under age 5 with stunning regularity every single month, if people knew that when you walk inside of a school, an average school in Iraq, a primary or secondary, you get a pit in your stomach thinking, oh my gosh, this is where kids are going to learn something. They don't have blackboards. They don't have pencils. They don't have notebooks. The toilets don't work. They're sitting in kind of cavernous rooms, sometimes on top of overturned garbage pails. when you see the hospitals and realize that these have turned by and large, often in the rural areas, into just big warehouses, and even in the more sophisticated areas, the headaches are just so overwhelming for the doctors to try the most basic problem solving, when you see how a society is being put to death, then you can't walk away and say, well, I think I'll focus on another issue. It has to become some integral part of your life to try to expose truth-telling. And I really think that's what we're about. Gandhi talked about truth force. I have never in my life encountered a situation, apart from the United States prison industry, where there was a greater need to just tell the truth. And actually, this is more life-threatening than what's happening in the prisons.
How do you respond to the U.S. saying, well, we're just merely imposing what the U.N. has called for here?
Well, again, I think it's very, very important to call attention to United Nations humanitarian coordinators who've said, we can't cooperate with this anymore. We have to say this is not working. I also think we have to look at, for instance, the most recent effort on the part of the United States to restore weapons inspectors to Iraq, and if Iraq, quote, complies with that offer to suspend the sanctions. We have to look at that and realize, first of all, that Russia, China, and France on the Security Council abstained from the vote. So you basically had amongst the big five, the United States and the United Kingdom, pushing that one through, that the United States had worked for many, many months to try to craft this, but the whole time that they were working to create Resolution 1284 as kind of a next step, the Iraqis were saying, by the way, we're not going to accept that. And then we have to try and understand why, from the Iraq side of the equation, there's a refusal to accept it. Now, you're not going to get that understanding reading the newspapers. They just won't tell. They simply say, well, you know, you try everything, and the Iraqis just are too obstreperous. They won't accept it. But I think that when you pick it apart a bit, it becomes kind of reasonable. That the Iraqis would not be keen on this Resolution 1284. First of all, the benchmark that's being imposed in terms of how they would comply with weapon inspection is utterly unrealistic, and this is what the French have said. They've said the word fully. The Iraqis are required to fully disclose 100% of any ownership on their part of any means to produce weapons of mass destruction. Well, there's nothing specific laid out. They aren't told you have to accomplish number one, number two, number three, number four. It's just fully comply. So anything that any weapons inspector wants to devise as a research possibility, you know, are there some scientists in some university who still remember how to create a delivery system? Might there be some means of, in the future, developing some kind of seed stock? This 100% compliance is impossible. So you've set an impossible goal in the first place. And then Resolution 1284 doesn't talk about lifting the sanctions. It only offers to suspend the sanctions. Well, what, you know, you can lift them up, but they can come right back down again. Now, what Iraq desperately needs to repair its damaged, debilitated infrastructure, to repair sewage and sanitation, to repair the electrical grid, to repair the hospitals, repair the schools, they need investors. And who is going to invest in Iraq? Well, quite logically, oil companies. They need to refurbish their oil industry. But under what circumstances will investors think, well, here's an attractive spot where we're going to take a risk? Not under the circumstance where these sanctions could come back down at the whim of the U.S. at any point that the U.S. wants to manipulate the oil prices in the region. And so if Iraq signs on to this, they're almost saying, please put us on perpetual welfare. Please put us on perpetual dependence of handouts. We want to forsake our opportunity to once again become a nation that can take care of itself by engaging in its own economy and trade. Now, should they do that? Would the United States, would anyone that's promoting this plan in the United States want themselves to go to a food pantry every day for their food, to rely on a clinic that may or may not have any medicines in it or medicine? To be constantly in the state of a humiliated welfare recipient, just only taking handouts? But somehow we expect that the Iraqis aren't really human beings, that there is a nation of clones of Saddam Hussein, and we can demonize them in a heartbeat.
In fact, yeah, when the U.S. speaks of Iraq, we don't so much hear of Iraq, we just hear Saddam Hussein, and the media seems to ignore the fact that I believe there's approximately 22 million people in the country. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, it sort of is, yes, 22 million people, and it makes me think for some of the media people that are so very, very bright, I want to say, look, you're going to the soup kitchen in terms of information. You're going to the State Department with your bowl, and the State Department fills it up with the same old stuff, the same old tired arguments, and you then peddle them to the U.S. public. We could have a menu. We could be informed people. For instance, you know, you'll if you hear anything beyond what about Saddam Hussein, you'll very reliably hear, he's so bad he builds palaces. And he's so bad, he takes the food and medicine and he hoards it and he only passes it out to his own people. Now, I'm not terribly interested in trying to break down the palaces argument. You can talk about how, in fact, there are roomfuls of useless currency. I mean, I think we need to recognize that the Iraqi dinar used to be worth $3 American. It now cost, when I was last in Baghdad in March of this year, 2,240 Iraqi dinar to buy $1 American. So the currency is, you know, but they have to put people to work on something. All right, I would not choose to build another one of these palaces. But basically, Iraq has a lot of cement. Jordan has even more. And these palaces are like, you know, I don't know if any of your relatives might have been buried in a big old mausoleum. It's just cement with some fancy stuff in front, and maybe, you know, they dig a fountain. Is it a useful way to spend people's time? All right, I will grant easily that I would not prefer that, but let me tell you, I do not like the idea that here in the United States, when we want to build something that will be a sign of power and ostentatious wealth and will possibly overwhelm other people, we build F-15 bombers. We build missile systems. We build weapons of mass destruction. And we take close to a third of every worker's income to build it. And we build prisons at a rising industry that's just appalling. So I think, wait a minute. Before we start to demonize someone else, could we examine the possibility that we can understand ruthlessness full well by looking at the situation here? I don't think it's good for us always to be absolving ourselves and pointing fingers at other people. And then, you know, you look to Britain, they just built that incredibly ostentatious dome. The Guardian said it looked like a giant home for Teletubbies. So should we just be pointing at palaces? And then there's the matter of Saddam Hussein hoards. And this one really does need to be, I think, looked at so seriously, in part because the United Nations people on the ground in Iraq are paid out of the money that comes from the revenue on the oil for food deal. Iraq never sees that revenue as cash. It all goes into an escrow account in the Bank of Paris in New York. Now, 30% of that money, no matter what amount is earned, is going to go immediately to pay for reparations from the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and the subsequent terrible misfortunes that occurred. Then another 10% goes to pay for expenses of the United Nations operating in the north. Now, another chunk of that money has to go to pay the salaries of the 600 people working for the United Nations to do inspection and oversight to make sure that food and medicine goes to its end destination point and then other United Nations related work. So 300 workers, Monday through Saturday, 6 days a week, are on the ground circulating through Iraq, checking to see, are they doing a good job distributing the relief goods that come into the country? That's the brief. Well, they are saying, and their coordinators have been saying, the answer to that question is yes, as well as can be expected under a situation that is unmanageable and impossible. These people are doing their level best. And when we tell that to the State Department, when we hand them the reports, when we show them the observation and the interpretation developed by relief experts on the ground in Baghdad, they take those reports, set them aside, don't even open them and say, that's not an official report. All right, were you over there in Iraq? Have you ever set foot in the country? And the answer to that is quite often no. The State Department people who are bright, my God, they're bright, they will not pay credence to the United Nations reports. They're dismissive toward them. And yet, they're willing to keep enacting policies that are costing the lives of hundreds and thousands of people. So it just seems to me that it's a very, very patently, calculatedly unfair position that the United States is assuming, and then trying to cover it by saying, well, it's all Saddam's fault. Saddam could change everything. All he has to do is comply. I think we need to look at that word comply. The U.S. wants compliance, all right. They want a compliant Saudi Arabia and a compliant Kuwait, who are so compliant that when the United States says raise those oil prices, they go up, and when the United States says take them back down again, they go down. The State Department has tried to tell us that Iraq is a threat to its neighbors, and the State Department cares about Iraq's neighbors. Is Iraq a threat to Turkey? Then how come Turkey just invaded Iraq and does so with great regularity and armed with U.S. weapons? Is Iraq a threat to Iran right now? I mean, Iran's got delivery systems for all kinds of different weapons of mass destruction, and Iran can invade in northern Iraq when it wants to. It's ridiculous to think that right now Iraq is a threat to Iran. And let's remember that over the 9 years of the Iran-Iraq war, Iraq could not win, and that was with U.S. assistance. Of course, the U.S. armed both sides. Is Iraq a threat to Jordan? Then why is the Jordanian populace screaming for an end to the sanctions? Why has the entire Arab League called for an end to these sanctions? Who is Iraq a threat to? Is Iraq a threat to Israel with 200 to 600 thermonuclear weapons? To Saudi Arabia with 30 United States bases there? A threat to Kuwait when the United States has assured them of its support? I think Iraq poses a threat to the United States' ability to control Iraq's resources. As a close friend said on the way over here, Iraq is in charge of the wrong piece of real estate right now, because the United States would like to say, that's our turf. That's got the strategic resource we want for the future, and we are going to maintain control over it. And I would submit that in smaller gatherings of State Department people and think tank people who are very influential in the United States government, people say, let's keep Saddam Hussein right where he is, crippled, but as a convenient excuse to maintain the status quo, to keep our troop force in the region, to keep the Iraqi oil off the market, or at least under our control when it goes on the market, and let's not rock this boat.
That's what you said last night in a talk to many people at Seattle University, that the sanctions, in fact, are strengthening Saddam's position in Iraq, which is the exact opposite image that the U.S. is presenting to U.S. citizens.
Well, and of course, you know, that sounds so crazy that the sanctions would strengthen the regime, but when you think about it, the only entity within Iraq that can order goods and products to come in legally is the government. And I think the analogy I used is if Seattle University was the only group in all of Washington State that could ever bring anything, import anything, or export anything, then I think, you know, Seattle University would have a pretty pivotal place within this state. And so, sure, I think that the fact that the only group that can really smuggle anything would probably be under the auspices of the current government leads to a fairly strong position for whatever economic activity is happening. And also, I think that something I never think of in Chicago in Illinois is that Indiana might invade us. I just never worry about that. But I think if you're living in Iraq, you have to worry that if a strong central government goes out of control, then a lot of different havoc could spring up. You might be subject to invasions of people who want to exploit that instability. And also, there could be civil wars that might break out within your society. And do the people of Iraq want the conditions of a Beirut or a Bosnia laid on top of the misery and suffering that they have right now? Not to mention the fact that this sanction regime has decimated the middle class. I mean, who can blame people? They love their kids. They see a future that looks so bleak. If they could get out, they've gotten out. Or they're making plans to go. And so, I mean, once upon a time in 1996, when I'd go to visit an Iraqi hospital, every resident in training or young doctor spoke the King's English. I'd be embarrassed about my Chicago twang, honestly. I'd try to talk slower so I wouldn't sound so ridiculous. Now, we sometimes have to kind of beg our driver, can you go in with us? He's a civil engineer who speaks very fine English, so that someone can translate for us, because the young doctors can't speak English. Well, the textbooks are all in English when they do get them, which is infrequently, and you're looking at a generation in every profession that is vastly hindered by their own substandard education. The pride is there, the will is there, the determination is there, but the factual education is absent. And this will cripple the country, and they know it. And so, you know, there's an archbishop in the South, Archbishop Kassab, a man I'm personally just very fond of. I've known him for some time now. When I first met him, he said to us, yes, do exactly what you're doing. He was just a parish priest in Baghdad. He was cleaning up his courtyard for getting ready to distribute lentils. And he said, we are a proud people. We don't want handouts. And I thought, oh, good, because we don't come over with very much. The next time I met him, he was in Basra, and he had been assigned as the archbishop of a very large southern swath of the country. And I said, Archbishop Kassab, I'm glad you didn't really want us to bring a lot of relief, because we hardly have anything, but we're very pleased to come and tell you we're working to end the sanctions. He put his head down on his desk. He said, I have completely changed my mind. Since I have been here and seen the need of people in the South, we will take anything we can get. Now, over the years, as we've talked to him, we've laid out our analysis that the sanctions have to do with the U.S. desire to control the oil wealth. He, very surprisingly, in my own living room where I live in Chicago in December of 1997, said, no, I think you are not right in that analysis. And we said, okay, give us yours. And he said, we believe that these sanctions are in place because the United States never wants to see again a strong and competent generation of Iraqis grow up and begin to take their place in the world. They want to see a debilitated, handicapped, stunted generation. And we thought, oh, that's too much. But after he left, you know, a number of us feeling troubled started to talk about that, and we realized, well, whether it was a truthful analysis of the motive or not, it is what's happening. And I believe the State Department of the United States knows it's happening, and still it persists. Now, what is the positive dimension? I think in a very, very positive way, and I wish so much we could impart this hope to the people we see in Iraq, but it's almost as though they're afraid to hope anymore. But you've got in The Economist, the April 4th issue, a very scathing article saying sanctions all wrong. That's not the choir talking. And you've got John Pilger's video, which is extremely detailed, professionally done. Pilger's credibility comes with it, and it's very, very good. And you've got a grassroots movement across the United States, Canada, and Europe that's working very hard, along with quite a number of third world countries who are starting to speak up. You've got the resignations of Hans von Spanik and Dennis Halliday. And, you know, what can people say when a guy from the State Department said the other day to me on a radio interview, well, we need to strengthen the hand of the UN. And I said, yes, but what do you say to these two who just resigned? So these are very, very positive signs. Here in Seattle, you've got Bert Sachs and the Citizens Concerned for the People of Iraq, along with several others, very, very strong and supportive groups from the American Friends Service Committee, a new developing Pax Christi group, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and quite a number of interchurch gatherings. And you've got Bert Sachs. I want to give a phone number if it's all right, so please, that people can get in touch with this group. It's a local campaign to end the sanctions against Iraq. They'll bring Dennis Halliday here in September. I know there will be a way to mark the 10th year since the sanctions were first imposed. That's August 6, 1990. And if anybody wants to come and join us in Washington, D.C., some sturdy folks from Chicago are biking there. I think they're not going to take me along on the bike ride. But you could make a hop from Seattle to Chicago and bike to D.C. with us, and there will be civil disobedience on August 7th, led by Martin Sheen, who plays the president in a TV show, I think. Anyway, for Bert, 206-789-5565, and an extremely helpful website. Students, if you're working on papers and you want to have your research, you know, vastly assisted, www.scn.org/CEPL. And if you ever come to Chicago, you know, I just think I read that wrong. They're kind of trying to make me remember to bring my reading glasses everywhere I go. But if you ever come to Chicago, we honestly don't even know where the keys are to my place. People are always welcome to come and join us in Chicago for this work. And I'm going to let Bert come into the microphone because I still can't read the writing.
I'm sorry. The last four letters of the website are CCPI, Charlie, Charlie, Peter Irene, Citizens Concerned for the People of Iraq.
I feel like I'm at the reading chart of the eye doctors. Try again, dear. Well, maybe that's the word for all of us. We must keep trying. And, Michael, I'm so grateful for this time that you've let me become a big garrulous on the subject, I think. But it does mean the world to us to try to respond to the cares and concerns of the Iraqis we've met.
Oh, no, we're grateful to have you here. There's another event that we had talked about before the show coming up on May 3rd.
Right. You know, if people could encourage their elected representatives, senators, congresspeople, aides, and media, to go to the Rayburn Building on May 3rd at 3 o'clock, and there they will hear an extremely impressive lineup. Representative Kucinich of Ohio, a Democrat, who really has some visions for a different kind of world, he suggested a Department of Peace. He has invited Scott Ritter, a former weapons inspector, who's a very rugged individualist, an independent thinker, a can-do Marine who just wants to solve the problem and define the problem. He'll be teamed up with Hans von Sponeck and Dennis Halliday, and these are the two who most recently, Hans von Sponeck, and then a year and a half ago, Dennis Halliday, resigned their posts as coordinators of distribution of food and medicine in Iraq. And something interesting, Hans von Sponeck's father was involved in the military plot to kill Adolf Hitler and was then executed. So you have one person who, as a youngster growing up, dealt with his father's act of conscience and, you know, the father's death and assassination. And then you have Dennis Halliday, whose father, growing up in Ireland at a time when pacifism was often an option regarded with great contempt as the Irish Revolutionary Army was forming itself. And he founded the War Resisters League and was a strong, strong advocate of pacifism in Ireland. So here are two people who, in their adult careers, have spent an entire adult lifetime trying to work as conscientious servants of the United Nations. And they have a vision of the United Nations. Now, remember, they come from neutral countries that don't have a vested interest, Ireland and Germany, in this situation in the way that the United States does. And they've been on the ground, and they've seen the reality. So what I'm so concerned about is that their voices be heard with equal time to the voices of commentators who come out of think tanks in Washington, D.C., and have never gone to Iraq, have never familiarized themselves further with the situation, and do come from a country with a vested interest in maintaining a status quo that's deathly and lethal and cruel and not going to bode well for the future generations of this country. Because, you know, we talk about rogue nations, and it just slides off our tongues. That's a rogue nation. That's a rogue nation. We have to stop them. I think we're going to have to reckon with the reality that around the world, people are talking about the rogue superpower, and it's us, and people are afraid of us. And do we want to be seen as the bullying, consumptive, and ignorant people whose empires was, and about whom others could only pray for the decline of the empire?
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're just out of time. Kathy Kelly, thank you for coming in. I've been talking with Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness. I can give you a 30 more seconds if...
just in case anyone comes to Chicago, please do give us a ring, 773-784-8065, and we have a website for Voices in the Wilderness, which is very well kept up. Chuck Quilty, the one to whom we ascribed the beginning of this, got stuck with the website, and he sticks with it. It's www.nonviolence, that's nonviolence.org/... And then think of vitamin W, but Voices in the Wilderness, VITW. And by email correspondence, we'd hope to keep up with you, and that's kkelly@igc.org. And we really do look forward to being in touch with as many as possible, but we know that one of the best bastions for work on this issue is right here in Seattle.